Pivotal moments call for truth-telling, and that's where Jesus is with his disciples in the gospel today. The movement will soon turn toward Jerusalem, likely with danger ahead. So Jesus wants to know what his followers are hearing and seeing and feeling. Up to this point, it's all been safely unspoken, but the stakes are about to rise dramatically. So he asks them to weigh in. "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" he wonders. And their breezy answers start to tumble out. "They think you are sort of spooky, Jesus, like the spirit of one of the old prophets has come to life. Or maybe you're John the Baptist, risen from the grave." Their responses seem superficial, ungrounded, I think, and since Jesus needs them to dig in, he rephrases the question. "And you, who do you say that I am?" Until now, the disciples could be fairly noncommittal, each day opening up without much input or risk on their part, while Jesus was teaching increasingly large crowds, explaining the law of Moses and fulfilling it, healing the sick and proclaiming freedom for the captives. He met people on the margins, lifted up children and women and the poor, and helped them see that there were possibilities beyond their current negative circumstances. Jesus condemned the systems that privileged the few over the many and showed the crowds that God was within every person and not locked away in some building or ritual. He told them that true worship was found in works of justice and mercy and that God's kingdom was now here and in their hands. And in that context, Jesus asked the disciples to look him in the eye and say what he means to them. "Who do you say that I am?" he asked them. Their silence, I believe, as they collect their thoughts and take some time to consider how it all adds up, before Peter breaks in and dares to say that Jesus, the carpenter from Nazareth, is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Sometimes we leave important truths locked up, unspoken due to inertia or silence out of fear, and then something happens. Someone gives us space to feel or room to grow. Someone asks what hurts and listens, no matter how fearsome our story might be. Someone says, "I see you, I hear you." And in that light, we find our feet and realize that the solid ground beneath us and the allies' arms around us can hold us up. That's what begins to happen in Peter and the others that day. And Peter's vulnerability invites Jesus to speak his painful truth. "The religious and civic leaders will be threatened by the ways I inspire the people who've been left out or left behind, so the powers that be will seek to kill me," he says. "But I will rise again. You see, I'm not the Messiah that you think you want. I will not swoop in, take control of the political authorities, and put my friends in power. God doesn't save in that way. Rather, if you follow me, I'll teach you how to save yourself and the world by sowing love instead of hate, sowing pardon instead of injury, sowing truth instead of falsehood, sowing hope instead of despair. You may lose what you think defines you by following the living God in this way, but you'll find your true self." He pauses and then picks up again. "I'll die in the process. Others will too. But together we'll discover life beyond our wildest imaginings." No wonder they hem and haw at first. Pivotal moments call for truth-telling. Who do you say that Jesus is? And what does it mean to follow him in this moment of crisis? Beyond the solace that his presence offers you, what does his witness call for in this time of racial reckoning and economic upheaval and global pandemic? If we speak the uncomfortable truth to power about privileging some over the many, about systems that deal death to black and brown bodies in disproportionate numbers, about seniors and singles who are isolated, about schools which rise in some zip codes and fall in others, then that truth will set us free to ensure that all people are thriving. The next step is always more listening, more study, more organizing, and I imagine like every new birth, it will be messy and hard, But Redeemer was made for this moment. When we see something, we can say something, and that courage can coalesce around common issues and struggles that belie our superficial differences within families or across town. Quaker philosopher Elton Trueblood suggests that we have trouble describing Jesus precisely because following in his way is so difficult. On a number of occasions, Trueblood told the story of John Woolman, a successful merchant in the 18th century who lived a relatively easy life until his faith convicted him of the offenses of holding slaves. After that, Woolman gave up a prosperous business, used his money to free enslaved men and women, and even started wearing undyed suits to avoid relying on dye that their stolen labor had produced. Says Elton Trueblood, "Occasionally, we talk of our Christianity as something that solves our problems, and there's a sense that it can. Long before it does so, however, when belief turns to action, when saying the truth in our hearts leads to doing what is right and true in our lives, then following Jesus can get us into trouble and increase the number of and intensity of our problems rather than reducing them, because we're called to love folks who are seen as unlovable, to die for them if necessary, to take the law of justice and mercy that God has written on our hearts and use it as a model for policies that promote the common good. We don't follow Jesus because it makes us feel good, though it does make us feel really good sometimes. No, we follow Jesus because life needs us to love in this radical way. We have neighbors and family members and parts of ourselves that are longing to be set free. What does this moment ask of you? If we haven't heard it before this chapter in Matthew, Jesus makes it absolutely clear here that God doesn't care that much about our creature comforts. God cares about us living consciously and honestly, that we embody integrity and courage and love. He says, if you want to have a worthwhile life, you're going to have to look for ways to give that life away. He says, if we want to save our lives, of necessity, we're going to hand over our petty obsessions and mistaken priorities. He says, we're going to have to think more about loving than of being loved, more of understanding than of being understood, more of forgiving than of being forgiven. Living a life that really matters will not allow room for clutching or hoarding or playing it safe. It asks instead for a less possessive way, a way that treats life like a gift to be shared instead of a commodity to be stored away. I would argue that this principle runs through all of life from top to bottom. Give up yourself and you'll find your real self. Lose life and it will be saved. Submit to death, the death of ambitions and secret strategies that put you in the center of things, and you'll finally live. Keep nothing back. No more secrets or life-giving words left unspoken, even the things that are hard to say. Let go of structures and systems that deal death. Nothing in us that has not died will ever be raised from the dead, wrote C.S. Lewis. When we follow Jesus in this way, we become Christ to each other, and loving that way is what will finally save us and save the world. Pivotal moments call for truth-telling. Who do we say Jesus is? I say he is sacrificial love embodied, and that we can be that too. Amen.